the S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that wishes you a happy new financial year. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me is Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm exceptionally well. And you good self?
I am very good.
And as always, Liam Flanagan, our talented producer, who's going to try and keep us on the straight and narrow and maybe pitch in with an occasional comment or maybe a good sound effect or two. We shall see what happens. Doc, today on the podcast, we're going to talk about the year in review. Today is the 29th of June. It is the last day of the financial year for traders. Of course, there's one more day left on Saturday, but it's all over for us today. So we'll have a bit of a look back. We'll answer the question the AFR asked of which stock will get to 200 bucks first, Cochlear or CSL. We'll talk a little bit about short selling and Amazon entering the pharmacy business. Look out, Terry White. And of course, because our listeners would be devastated if it didn't happen, I'm going to saddle up. I'm going to await starter's orders on the Motley Fool high horse. All right, let's get on with it. Mate, the year has almost finished, and you know this answer. So I'm not going to ask you, but I'm going to ask our listeners to just guess. Actually, no, I'm going to ask Liam just because that's much more fun. Liam, the average year for the stock market, about 10 or 11%. What do you reckon happened on the ASX in the last 12 months?
I'll say 10 or 11%.
10 or, you know what? That is a very good guess because it's always going to be around. I like that a lot. You know what's funny? Despite the Brexits, the Trumps, the... What else do we have, Doc? We had Amazon, fears about Amazon entering the retail space, all that kind of good stuff.
Property market crashing.
Yeah, valuations are too high. The ASX was up, including dividends, which is what we should always count. 13.4%. This was an above average year for the market, despite all the paper headlines of everything that could and would and should go wrong. We had a pretty good year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, without dividends, that's 8.6%. So the price index that we normally talk about, the ASX 200, will show up 8.6%, depending on what happens today, of course. But the total market, unless something crashes horribly today, will be a market with an average beating performance on the ASX, which is pretty impressive. Now, I'm not going to ask Liam this one because, Liam, you did very well, mate. Well done. That was within 20%, give or take. We'll give you that one.
Thank you.
And that was unfair of me to bring it on. My apologies, mate. I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll make Liam jump through a hoop. But I will go back to Doc because, Doc, you should know some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'll try.
Over the last 12 months, so we'll go back to price only because these are only the price numbers I've got. So the ASX was up 8.6%.
Mm-hmm.
Which of the sectors of the ASX do you reckon was up the most over the last 12 months?
I'll take information technology.
Oh, no. That was number three.
That was number three.
And information technology was up 29.8%.
Okay.
That's triple the average market year. 29.8% for IT. There were two higher than that, mate. Give me one of them if you can.
I can take a wild
guess. Before you do, listeners at home, just have a think yourselves and just think, okay, what do I reckon over the last 12 months, what was up the most? Which sector of the ASX? All right, Doc, over to you.
Okay. I'm not even sure which one it would be. I was going to say marijuana stocks. But
that's possible, but not strictly speaking an ASX 200 sector. So we'll leave those aside.
Is it mining?
Yes, well done. In fact, the top two sectors were both mining-related sectors. The energy sector, so this is oil and gas, up an astonishing 38% over the last 12 months.
Wow.
And resources, so that's basically metals and minerals, up 36%.
Wow.
IT third at 29.8. They are astonishing gains.
Fantastic.
It really does reinforce the cyclical nature of mining. Mm-hmm. If we'd done this a couple of years ago, they would have been in the bottom couple of sectors. Mm-hmm. Mining stocks are still largely well down on their highs, but have a really great 12 months off very, very low levels, up 35 and 38% respectively, which is just astonishingly good.
Fantastic
returns. All right, mate, I'm going to give you a couple more to try and guess for me, just to make it fun for me and fun for our listeners. Listeners, what do you think was the worst performing sector on the ASX last year? And I'll give you a clue.
Give me a clue. Come on.
No, the clue's going to give it away, I think. This sector is dominated by a particular company, put it that way.
Okay. Should I take consumer discretionary?
Oh, no, you shouldn't take consumer discretionary. Consumer discretionary, these are things that you have discretion over buying. So this is not supermarket stocks. These are retailers that you might go fashion in particular and consumer discretionary, that kind of stuff. Consumer discretionary was up 11.5% for a market-beating return.
Fantastic.
This was a different sector. It's dominated by one company. Your least favorite company in the ASX, I'll say, Doc, just for the fun of it.
My least favorite company? Banking?
No, come on. What's the one you give me grief about all the time?
Huh. Is there one company I give you grief about all the time?
There really is.
Okay, I get it. Telecommunications,
that's,
I guess.
That's the one. Yeah. Telcos, because it was dominated by Telstra, down 35%. Mm. So energy was up 38%. Telstra, basically, telecommunications sector is Telstra plus a few, down 35% over the last 12 months. Now, we know all this stuff, Doc, and let me go through a couple just quickly. Healthcare was up 26%, materials up 25%, consumer staples was up 24%, believe it or not, which is astonishing for consumer staples. Industrials was up a bit. And the losers, the financial services sector. So for all those people who love their bank stocks, and I don't blame you for loving your bank stocks, but they're down 3.3% over the last 12 months. And utilities, so thinking about the power providers and infrastructure stocks, down about 6%.
That's not too bad.
So there you go. Wasn't worth holding the big end of town. Was worth holding some miners. And if you held Telstra, it was a pretty crappy year. I know that because I actually own shares in Telstra. So my apologies. It was a tough year for poor old Telstra. And I know you feel very sorry for it, Doc.
Oh, I do. I mean, you know, Well, Telstra is a great stock, right?
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's go from the year review and let's talk about the year ahead. There was a question in the AFR this week, and the article's title, I think, or at least the premise was, who will join Cochlear and CSL in the ASX's $200 club? They were trying to look at which was the next stock to go to $200. What's your guess, Doc?
Well, my answer is, does it matter?
Well, yeah.
Should I really?
Don't we all want $200 stocks?
Well,
I want all my stocks to go to $200, don't I?
No, there are $1,000 stocks too. I mean, but
I don't want those to go to $200.
Yeah,
that'd be bad. I just want the other ones to go to $200.
Okay, so I think the problem here is a lot of people just look at the number 200 and think, well, it's a big number. Yeah. Is a $200 stock any better than a $2 stock? I don't know.
100 times better, isn't it?
No, it's not, because I mean, what you own is really a fraction of the company, right? So if you own $5,000 in a company and equates to 0.0001%, whether it's a $200 stock or a $2 stock or a $20 stock does not matter, right? What matters really is, you know, what fraction of the company you own, and how, you know, and the market capitalization of the company is basically the total number of shares out multiplied by the share price.
Should we choose an analogy? Let's go for the economist's favorite analogy, the investor's favorite analogy. Mm. Let's talk about a pizza for a second, because we love talking about pizzas. Well, I do. I like Domino's as a company, by the way, as well. Mm. Let's talk about pizza. So what you're telling me is that a $200 pizza and a $2 pizza would be the same thing?
No, I did not say that. I said one pizza is a pizza, and whether you have whether you divide that pizza into four pieces,
yes,
or eight pieces, it's effectively still the pizza. But, you know, and if you own 1/8 of the pizza, you own 1/8 of the, you know, pizza.
Right. So what you're telling me is there could be a $200 pizza. You can have the whole pizza worth $200, so I can have the whole thing for $200, or I can have 100 slices for $2 each.
Yeah.
So effectively, all I'm getting is the same pizza, right?
Yeah. Well, you're getting a piece of the pizza, and you decide how much of the pizza you want to have, right? You can have half the pizza, right? Or you could have 1/4 of the pizza. It's your choice.
So it's not so much the price that matters, it's how much of the pizza I'm getting for the price I'm paying.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's not much fun.
Oftentimes I hear people, they say, oh, that's, you know, like $150 stock. I don't think I can buy that. It looks expensive.
Yeah.
The price of the stock does not tell you whether it's expensive or not, right? It's price relative to something, whether price relative to earnings, price relative to operating earnings, price relative to sales, whatever. That, right, you know, you could use as a gauge to decide if it's expensive or not, but not just the price itself.
Now, you know my favorite company.
Hmm. Well, which one is it?
Come on, my very favorite company.
Kogan?
No, it's a US company.
Oh, okay. Amazon?
No. Striking out here. Think about Uncle Warren.
Oh, Berkshire.
There we go.
Hathaway.
So Berkshire Hathaway, Uncle Warren Buffett's business, and we've talked about Warren a couple of times in this podcast before. Mm-hmm. Even Liam could spell his name in his sleep. Mm-hmm. The Berkshire Hathaway shares, the Class A shares, $285,000 right now. Mm-hmm. So if you want to talk expensive stocks, and as you say, Doc, that's exactly the story, right? But Berkshire is $284,000 a share. It could be split 1,000 ways, maybe $284 a share, and I could own 1,000 times the number of shares, but I'd still have the same interest in Berkshire Hathaway, and that's kind of the key point.
I think one thing I'll point out is, I think some people, I mean, if you have a $260,000 share, effectively to buy one share, you need to have at least... you need to have at least $260,000. So one of the problems with bigger, you know, such large share prices is that you can't own a small fraction of the company.
Yeah.
Right. That's a problem. And that's why some companies split the stock. affected and become too large.
We might talk about stock splits another time, mate, but I think it's a really good point because we do know, for example, that companies like to split their stock to make it seem like it's more somehow affordable.
Yeah.
And they're playing on our human motivations, to your point before, of feeling like, well, it's a lower price per share, therefore it must be cheaper. Mm. They know full well it's not. We know full well it's not. It's a confidence trick, and I'm not a big fan, but companies keep doing it because they're interested in short-term share prices.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, let's move on. Speaking of prices and speaking of companies that are expensive, let's talk a little bit about short selling. Now, we've talked about that a little bit before, but let's kind of, there's been a couple of Australian companies, a particular US company you're a little bit fond of.
Mm-hmm.
And the short sellers have been running rampant. So in the last little while, we saw Aconex, maybe this time last year, mm-hmm. maybe a bit later, one of the highest shorted stocks before mm-hmm. it was taken over. Nanosonics, a favorite of mine, another company that had a high short interest. And of course, everyone's favorite car company, or your favorite car company, the big T, Tesla, not to be confused with Telstra. What is your view on short selling?
Okay. So for those people who don't know what short selling effectively means, I go and borrow stocks from people who actually own the stock. I then sell it in the market, right? And for borrowing the stock, I essentially say, well, I'm borrowing the stock from you. I'm going to pay you some interest over time mm-hmm. for borrowing your stock. And I'm guaranteed that I'm going to return the stock back to you when you ask for it or in due course.
Right.
I take the stock from you. I sell it in the market. And then what I'm basically hoping is the stock price is going to go down. And if it goes down substantially, I buy it at cheap in the market and I give you back your stock, right?
Okay.
So I make money if the stock goes down.
Right.
Now, fundamentally.
So let's put this in a little bit of detail just to help people understand a little bit. So shares of Liam's Learjets are selling at $100 a share and you reckon they're probably worth 10.
Yep.
So you go out and you say, well, I'll borrow the shares off Scott Phillips, off me, and you sell those shares and get you $100 and you're hoping that when they fall to $10, you buy that share back for 10, give them back to me, and you pocket the $90 profit you made by effectively selling at a higher price and buying back at a lower
price.
Absolutely. All right. So that's what short selling is. Tell me more about how it applies and whether or not it's a smart idea.
Right. So, okay. So fundamentally, I actually don't like short selling. And the reason I don't like
I'm glad you can come back next week.
we have to agree on something.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not going to be Tesla or Telstra. So let's go with short selling.
So I think the problem with short selling, at least as an investor, is this, right? In your example of this $100, somebody's making a valuation call and saying, well, it's worth $10, right? You need to be right on that valuation call to make $90, right? Now, your upside is really capped, right? I mean, you can basically hope that $100 stock goes to zero.
Okay.
Right, and your upside is basically capped at $100.
Right. Yep.
Right. If I go long, and I think the company has a long opportunity and a big opportunity over time, there is no. I mean, theoretically speaking, okay, there is always an upside cap, but it is not capped at $100. If you're right, and if you're holding it for the long term,
when you say go long, you're saying if you buy the shares in a normal transaction, you hold them for as long as you want to.
Right.
The shares could go up. So Berkshire started at $50 a share 50 years ago. Now it's at $250,000 a share.
Exactly. That's like what like. Thousands of times.
Right. So Apple's gone from $2 to whatever it is now.
So it's like whatever, $200 almost.
Right. So if you shorted Apple almost at any time after Steve Jobs returned, you lost an absolute truckload.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So I mean, I think short selling is trying to take, advantage of some short-term opportunities, or it could be valuation, it could be. And I think the other thing I don't like about short selling is that often what happens with short selling is that short sellers are typically big funds or hedge funds. And what they would do is then they would often use the analyst community, or they would use newspapers, they would use all sorts of approaches and opportunities to try to actually drive the price down.
Okay.
Right. And short selling, I think, there are two types of things. You can, if you short sell a company which has financial need, especially like those companies which are financial transactions type companies, financial services type companies which would depend a lot on the trust of the consumers and of the market and so on, because they need to raise money. It is easier, theoretically speaking at least, to create a sentiment where you hurt the company. And if you create, you know, you can create a self-perpetuating sort of loop where, you know, okay, there's people are short selling, the stock price is going down. You know, you create some news, some uncertainty, fear, and the stock price goes down even further.
Particularly because maybe consumers hear about it, they stop shopping there. We saw a company in the US called Lumber Liquidators not long ago where there was a big, big short sale case made. This is a terrible company. They're poisoning their customers.
Absolutely.
So not only does the shares start falling, but customers say, well, hang on, I've seen the news. I'm not going to buy from them, which actually creates the exact weakness that the company is expected to suffer, which then helps the share price, which creates more weakness, and it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle.
And I'll clarify with that, you know, I actually owned that stock. So I've suffered through that one. what happened in that particular case is that the company was cleared by the California Safety Board, whichever company that, you know, the safety board that looks at, you know, whether it is poisoning people or not. But that doesn't matter at that point. By the time you're cleared, the sentiment has been so bad that people have stopped buying their, you know, their lumber.
Now, to be clear, we're not necessarily saying there's anything untoward in the short case. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't. We're not suggesting there is, but there are opportunities and circumstances where that can be a self-perpetuating, self-reinforcing cycle.
Yeah. So two examples you made here, like Aconex, for example, right? Mm-hmm. The Aconex short thesis.
Now, what's Aconex, mate?
Okay. Aconex was an ASX listed company, which we had recommended in our services.
Thank you for mentioning that. We did.
Yes, we did.
I think it was your idea, as I recall.
Well, our idea.
You're a generous man.
It was basically a cloud-based construction project management company. So basically, you know, managing construction.
Yep.
And basically providing all the tools for doing
really cool tech. Puts the architects together with the building owners, put together with the subcontractors.
Exactly.
Putting everything in one place. It's all in the cloud rather than send plans backwards and forwards. Cool. So we like that a lot.
We like that a lot. You know, I used to call it the Google of the construction world.
Oh, that's sexy. Look at that.
So you
should be in marketing.
Yeah, it was a really cool company founded here. And what people basically said as well, you know, maybe we don't like the accounting here. Maybe they're doing some aggressive accounting.
Yep.
You know, there may be capitalizing some R&D, and then look at that sky high valuation and things like that.
And to be fair, at one point, I think organic growth did slow a little bit, so maybe there's a bit of fundamental kind of concern about growth levels.
Right.
Shorters jumped on. They said, this is going to somewhere lower than this.
Yeah.
What happened?
And the price did go down substantially, actually. At one point, I think it had hit $8 and it had gone all the way down to, I think, $4.
That sounds about right from memory.
From memory. But then what happened? It, you know, another big company noticed, right, and took advantage and basically said, hell, here's a offer around $7 something.
So US soft company, software company,
Oracle? Small company called Oracle. So it's basically a database company. Oracle decided that this is a good fit for them
in their
move to the cloud and like what they saw. And they basically made a buyout offer and the company got sold.
If you were short at $4, and the shares got sold at what, 760?
760, 770, something like that.
So you pretty much lost half your money.
Oof, yeah.
Brutal.
Pretty brutal.
Brutal. And then there's Tesla. Come on, tell us. I'm going to keep you short on this one because I know you could talk about Tesla for most of today and a large chunk of tomorrow. So, but tell me about the Tesla short story.
Okay, so the Tesla short story is interesting because it actually started not with Tesla, but it started with another company of Elon Musk called SolarCity. There, the short thesis was a relatively simple short thesis. So SolarCity basically used to lease solar panels to people.
That was pretty cool. So rather than actually buying the panels,
they would come
and put them onto the roof for you. They'd own the panels, but you'd kind of get cheaper electricity. And it was a bit of a kind of a way to put solar on the roof without having to stump up a large amount up front.
Right. And it was basically a financial arbitrage situation, right? So what basically was happening in that case was SolarCity was, you know, borrowing money at a certain rate.
Yep.
And basically giving you the panels and charging you a slightly higher rate, which is what the banks do all the time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally.
So it was basically, you know, financial services operation.
Yeah.
In a cool area. A short seller called Jim Chanos, and this is my version of the story at least. So I'll caveat that.
I'll give the unbiased story later, but you give your version first.
So a short seller called Jim Chanos, who is one of the most famous short sellers on Wall Street,
and a very successful short seller too.
Well, I would caveat that. I think he's called very successful because he was very successful with one short selling, which was of Enron.
He's got a few dollars to his name, though, to be fair.
He's got a few dollars.
He hasn't struggled for a quid.
But his fund has been, I think, losing money to the market, losing to the market for some time.
Okay.
Right. So he was a short SolarCity.
Mm-hmm.
And SolarCity basically depended on raising money from the market, right? So okay. there, if you short it and you create a sentiment where you think that, oh, this company is going to go bankrupt, this company is, you know, and if, you know, if you're going to go bankrupt, who's going to lend you money?
Mm-hmm.
It creates issues in the bond market. It creates issues in the equity market.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the stock price went down or mm-hmm. started going down. And then it can become self-fulfilling, right, mm-hmm. to some extent. Elon Musk, who was one of the largest shareholders, basically then decided.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. He decided that, well, I'm going to merge it with Tesla.
Okay.
So he made a buyout offer, an opportunistic buyout offer, at I think at like 30% above.
It helps when you own most of both companies, let's be fair.
Exactly.
Well, not most, but a controlling interest.
Yeah. So, and I'll be honest, I don't think, you know, in that case, it looked like it was done basically to, you know, save his own money, I guess.
Right,
and I guess he figured that, well, you know, in this case, this is the best solution I've got. So they acquired SolarCity, mm-hmm. and they basically SolarCity shorts then moved to Tesla.
Okay.
Right. And Tesla's short story, I think, has changed from this company cannot make, this company is overvalued,
yeah.
or this company is niche, there's no demand for its product, to, oh, there's demand for its product, they can't make cars, enough cars, to, you know, oh, the battery cars are going to burn down and things like that, right?
Okay.
So the short
piece, so up front, it was kind of a case of lots of dreams, not much upside.
Yeah.
This is just fundamentally overvalued.
Yeah.
And then it kind of went to a combination of, well, okay, there's demand for it, but they can't make them profitably. And
yeah.
now there's some sense of maybe the shorts are moved towards, they're going to run out of cash before long. I think that's the current short.
Right now there's multiple, I think the short sellers have multiple prongs here. One is that they won't be able to make enough cars to
right.
fulfill the demand. And then when they think that the demand is going to get fulfilled, then the story changes to, well, there's not going to be enough demand because, you know, these guys have made electric vehicles sexy. Other people are going to come in and start making electric vehicles. Everybody's going to buy Jaguar's electric vehicles or BMW's electric vehicles and not Tesla's.
Right.
So there's all sorts of stories around this. And I think so some of this might be true,
mm-hmm.
but I think what people forget here is, you know, this is a transition in vehicles
mm-hmm.
from ICEs or internal combustion engines to electric vehicles.
Yep.
Tesla is a pure electric vehicle company.
Mm-hmm.
All the other companies have incentive issues, right? The dealers want to sell ICE cars,
mm-hmm.
not electric vehicles, because they make more money servicing the ICE cars,
right?
Tesla doesn't have dealer networks.
So just to hit that up a little bit, so most new car dealers make far more money from the servicing of those cars than actually selling them in the first place.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's that. And then there's the demand issue. I mean, you know, when people talk about demand, I say, well, you know, look at Tesla's backlog. That's one. Second, just realize this. Just in the U.S. alone, 300,000 BMWs are sold, or 350,000 BMWs. That's just BMWs,
mm-hmm.
right? Add the Audis and add everything else. That's mm-hmm. a lot of luxury vehicles.
The Jags.
Yeah,
yep.
a lot of luxury vehicles. All that Tesla needs to do is just get a fair share of it, you know, of the pie, and it should be fine, right?
So as long as it's running out of money first.
Yeah, so as long, okay, so tackling that, I think, you know, there, I think, my thinking there is that they should always be able to tap the equity market.
Mm-hmm.
They might be always able to tap the bond market. They might have to pay more
mm-hmm.
to, you know, in terms of interest, which is not good. Elon Musk is a wealthy person.
Mm.
And I think if the Tesla share price were to fall a lot, there are a lot of wealthy tech companies who would probably be happy to put in a few billion dollars at a discount buy this company.
Take a little corner stake.
Take a corner stake. And there are, you know, corner stakes held by, you know, mm-hmm. so there's a big Chinese company, one of the biggest internet companies called Tencent,
mm.
which owns a 5% stake in Tesla. So I think that the story about it going out of money is just, you know, fear and uncertainty and despair created in the market. It creates opportunities for people who are long like me to buy the stock.
All right. That's enough of you tearing the bull case on Tesla. I think you're probably right, frankly. I think the question really, to some extent, and with all companies, any company that's likely to be forced to raise capital at a lower price should see its share price fall by definition when it raises that capital, because shareholders smell the desperation. They're not going to offer a high price. We've seen plenty in the past raise more capital, particularly small Australian companies, raise more capital at lower and lower prices. Mining companies are a classic on that. iCar Asia was raised money at lower and lower prices. So at some point that does create a share price fall. And if you'd taken that view on iCar Asia and said, I'll short it because I'm going to have to raise more capital at some point at a lower price, you would have been dead right. The question for Tesla and for you is that, you know, is whether or not there's enough passion, enough belief, enough confidence in the company that they don't have to raise money at a particularly steep discount if they have to raise money at all. And that'll be the interesting question, I think. And that's where some of the more respected shorters, if I can say that, or those who are short Tesla are taking a bet that they believe they'll benefit, not because Tesla goes broke, but because when it has to raise money at lower prices, that forces the share price down, and that would be their short profit.
I'm going to add just one quick thing, and which is what people forget is, you know, the number of deposits that Tesla holds, mm-hmm. and that's money, free money, essentially. That's a type of capital raise, and Tesla has just started now rolling out. It started converting those orders
right.
into reservations into orders,
right.
and it's asking essentially for another $2,500 grand to convert that. Right, if you get 100,000 people to actually pay $2,500. That's a lot of money. That's basically a capital.
That covers a few bills.
That's a sweet capital raise.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of American companies, though, let's have a look at Amazon. Report out this morning, and Terry White should be quaking in their boots, that Amazon is buying a $1 billion pharmacy business in the US. It is getting into the distribution of pharmaceutical products. Mm. And it's something that's been kind of mooted for a while. The $1 billion buy wiped $15 billion off the market cap of its competitors because investors are so worried that Amazon is going to come and disrupt the pharmacy business like it has almost every business before it. What say you? Should we be concerned about Amazon in pharmacy? What should the Terry Whites and Chemist Warehouse in Australia be thinking? What's the future for pharmacy in the wake of Amazon?
Okay. So I am always worried when Amazon enters into something. So Amazon is a company that should not be taken lightly.
Uh-huh.
I think pharmaceutical companies or pharmaceutical distributors and so on that had their share prices, go down. I think it reflects the belief that, you know, Amazon would be a very aggressive competitor.
Yep.
It will be able to negotiate good prices with pharma companies, mm-hmm. and therefore maybe, you know, and maybe it'll bundle it with its Prime offering and give you free shipping on your drugs, right? Why would you not? I think, you know, companies like Terry White and Chemist Warehouse and so on, they should look out. And this is, I think it's still early days. They're going to roll out in the U.S. I mean, by the time they decide to come to Australia, it'll be several years, I guess, right? This is a regulated area, so they need regulatory approval. From where I stand, I think I would say that, you know, anything that Amazon does, people should watch and watch very carefully. Add just that, you know, it's not always the case that Amazon is going to kill it. You know, locally we have a very successful Kogan. While Amazon is around, eBay is around. So maybe people can coexist.
I think that's the key one for me. I think if I was a betting man, and I own Amazon shares for full disclosure, I think you do too.
Yes.
So if I was a betting man, I would say that, look, there was a lot of overblown response to Amazon's launch here last year, almost 12 months ago now, actually, not far off that. So it was Amazon's coming, everything's going to die. Mm. And then 2 months later, it was, oh, Amazon's not going to kill anything. It's been a failure of a launch. And I think both of those views are stupid in the short term. Mm-hmm. Amazon is not trying to destroy everyone else on day one, but they absolutely are intending to take very large shares of the markets they operate in over time. They'll build that mass, they'll build that momentum over time. And I think to expect that just because Amazon announces a deal that all of a sudden everything goes to pot is probably silly. I got to say, though, I don't want to be in the way of Amazon when it comes through, particularly if you can't respond. So I like Kogan. We've talked about it before. I think Amazon and Kogan can coexist because the market for online retail is big enough. That's my view. For what it's worth, though, I think at some point you don't want to be a bricks and mortar retailer trying to fight a rear guard action when everything is moving online and, frankly, Amazon is leading that charge. If you're in its way, you need to at least be in its wake. If you can draft Amazon like Kogan is effectively doing, then you're probably doing okay potentially. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be there necessarily 25 years, but for now you're doing okay. If you're a bricks and mortar retailer with no reasonable response to that, and if all of a sudden I could get all my pharmaceuticals online very simply and easily, then why would I not? And I think to your point about Prime, that's, you know, Amazon Prime is all about, you know, free 2-day delivery. It's all about feeling like you're part of a club. You want to then put all your volume through that. It's a very, very attractive thing to do. So I frankly think traditional pharmacies are under pressure already from the likes of Chemist Warehouse. I would imagine Amazon entering this space, if and when they do, and to your point, this is regulated, so it does require a law change. But I've got to figure people power at some point makes that happen, mm-hmm. whether the pharmacies like it or not. And I don't want to be a pharmacy owner when Amazon turns up on my doorstep.
Absolutely agree.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Guess what?
Guess what? Tell
it's
me.
Time for me to mount on my high, high horse. And you were worried we weren't going to have enough time, Doc.
Oh, well. Go on. Tell ride the horse.
With that invitation, why would I not? Fools, today in the papers, in the AFR and the Herald, and I'm sure other papers, was a report from ASIC. And that report was that 90% of self-managed super funds that ASIC looked into were, in their words, dodgy. Or effectively, that were their words. The advice being given to those funds, the way those funds were set up and constructed, the way people thought about how they invested with their SMSFs is bad, according to the regulator. And it really does, it's a real reminder that despite all of the protections, all of the laws, all the regulations, all of the Royal Commissions, quite frankly, there are still people out there trying to take your money without giving you a decent service in return. And it comes down to conflicts. We talked about conflicts a lot, and I will keep ranting about conflicts for as long as they happen, because if you don't think about it, if you don't worry about it, if you're not keeping an eye on it, people will take advantage of you. And ASIC is saying there is too many one-stop shops. Those are people who are saying, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll sell you a property. I'll get you a loan. I'll set up your SMSF and I'll clip the ticker all the way through. And am I thinking about your best interest? Well, in ASIC's words, probably not. And that's the real concern. So you've got to keep mindful of. And frankly, I'm glad ASIC's doing it. They need to do more of it. And frankly, the government need to fund them a whole lot better to root out this kind of crap that's going on in the industry where that people feel like they can just create a product, sell it to some poor, unsuspecting schmuck who doesn't know any better because you come with a respectable suit, you show them your qualifications, say, I will help you, trust me. This is what I do for a living. I'll look after you. And for too long, and still it happens, financial planners, financial advisors are just quasi-salesmen. They're not genuinely looking out for their customers' best interests. Again, I will say, if your financial planner, if your advisor, if your accountant is getting money from anyone other than you, then they are taking you for a ride. Maybe, just maybe, the advice is decent. Maybe, just maybe, you're getting a decent go and they're doing the right thing. But how hard is it when you're being offered incentive after incentive after incentive to keep yourself on the straight and narrow? We all like to think we could do it. I'm not sure many people can. And if you're an accountant, if you're an advisor, if you're a planner, and you're getting a kickback from somebody other than the customer, how can you honestly believe you're doing the right thing? And if you're a customer of those guys, you've got to ask yourself, do you really think you are getting unbiased advice? Even subconsciously, do you not think your behavior, your planner's behavior is being influenced even a little bit by the incentives they're being provided, by the free trips, the holidays, the dinners, the kickbacks, the commissions, all of the stuff that goes along with that? It's human nature. It's very, very hard. We know psychologists tell us it's incredibly hard to resist the power of incentives. And so even those who think they're doing the right thing, who are probably almost certainly doing the right thing, maybe they aren't, because those incentives are just so, so, so insidious. It is time for ASIC to stamp it out. There should not be anybody paying a financial planner other than the customer or the client. And until that changes, I will keep ranting.
Man, that was a long rant.
That was good, wasn't it? I almost didn't take a breath.
That was great. I'm going to ask you one quick, give me one line why ASIC does not like property. What's ASIC's problem with property? Can you explain why that was a problem?
So the issue they bought, I love that question, Doc. Thank you. It's an authority dictionary. I'll take it. ASIC's point was that most of these SMSFs that are being set up by these one-stop shops are being set up with one asset, often in mind, a single asset, which is a single property. And basically someone's saying to you, look, you know, you've got a couple hundred grand in your fund over here with Australian Super. I'll tell you what, I'll take you 200 grand. I'll put it into a self-managed super fund. We'll borrow another 70%.
Great.
We'll buy an $800,000 property. Mm-hmm. Look how much money is working for you. This will be fantastic. And ASIC is saying, firstly, there's massive conflicts involved in there, right? Mm-hmm. And secondly, if you're trying to save for your retirement, having all of your retirement nest egg in a single property, in a single place, in a single suburban street, in a single city, that's not exactly diversification. ASIC are saying, you know what? There needs to be more diversification in a self-managed superannuation product, any superannuation product.
Good
having
point.
All of your eggs in one property basket is just
dangerous.
Crazy, and they're dead right.
Yeah, they're right. Cool. Thank you. Whew,
that feels better. You feel better?
I feel better. Love it. I love it when you talk about property.
You just want the price to go down. We know that.
I love the price going down.
I thought I'd get away with this without mentioning property, Liam. I apologize. We'll cut that out later. Fools, we will put a quick shout out to. Don't forget, we do love to hear your feedback. So if you've got an idea, a question, a comment, a topic, feel free to send us an email, either info@fool.com.au. That's our email address, info@fool.com.au. themotleyfool.com.au or hit us up on Twitter at themotleyfoolau. We'd love to answer your questions. We'd want to know what you're thinking and what you'd like us to cover. But in the meantime, Doc, that wraps us up. Now, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favourite Android podcast app. None of this Apple stuff, Doc. All about Android. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big 5-star rating and tell your friends. It helps us rank higher and lets more people discover the podcast. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of Foolish Insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.